All rise. The Supreme Court for the state of Nevada is now in session. The Honorable Justice Pickering presiding.
Please be seated, everyone. And forgive us the sauna that is the courtroom today. It is incredibly hot. We've got the doors open in the hopes that this will cool things down a little bit. And we have cold water on the tables for the lawyers, and that's the best we can do under the circumstances. So with that, I'll call the next case. We're still waiting for Justice Perigary. Wait a moment. Justice Perigary, as you can see, is appearing remotely from Carson City today. If he and you have questions, there's a little bit of downtime between him speaking and you speaking, so try not to talk over one another. But with that, how much time would you like to reserve for rebuttal?
I will ask to reserve 12 minutes for rebuttal.
12 minutes?
Yes.
Very well. You ready to proceed?
Yes.
Please do. Thank you.
Esteemed Justices, my name is Augustus Claus. I am appearing on behalf of the appellant, Ken Juan McDaniel. Today before you, Your Honor, presents at least four issues, some of which are thornier than others. With respect, I'll address them in turn, as I believe they should most logically follow. The first is whether or not the district court improperly found that the appellant's probation was not subject to graduated sanctions. Your Honor, this is probably the single most important issue that must be addressed, whether you take the state's opposition or ours, as it is foundational to the court's analysis, no matter how you start or end, and whether you read it from the beginning or the end. Essentially, Your Honor, with the state.
Sorry, hang on one second. I don't think we started the clock.
I didn't even notice. I apologize. Essentially, Your Honors, in this circumstance, the district court found that the appellant was wholly outside of the protections of the graduated sanctions put in place by AB 236 by virtue of the fact that the crime substantively occurred prior to the July 1st, 2020 effective date of that statute, as embodied in NRS 176A.510 and NRS 176A.630. Your Honor, the court relied on the Chamberlain line of decisions from the Court of Appeals in reaching that conclusion. In doing so, it discounted the Supreme Court's decisions in the Muratella line of cases that seemed to indicate contrary. At the end of the day, Your Honors, the Elwin case seems to be dispositive of this issue. It was filed as an unpublished opinion by the court. It was mentioned in our opening brief, and there were several learned justices who came to the conclusion that Mr. Elwin, though he committed the offense prior to the effective date of AB 236, he was sentenced before that date as well, and the legislature intended AB 236 to be effective for crimes in which, no matter when they were committed, either before or after the effective date, but were sentenced after the effective date of the statute. That's the language of Elwin. Elwin says, in pertinent part, Your Honors.
None of those cases are binding precedent on us, so it would be more helpful to talk about the retroactivity principle and why that doctrine doesn't apply. In other words, that the event that is being measured here is the probation revocation proceeding rather than the crime itself, if you follow what I'm saying.
Certainly, Your Honor. And so that was one of the items that's part of the appellant's opening brief, is in the the Chamberlain line of cases from the Court of Appeals, and in the district court's opinion, it relies on the federal court's analysis of probation, of its analogy for probation and parole. Unfortunately, as a federal practitioner and people who have practiced in federal criminal court, they know that when someone comes back for a violation of parole or community supervision in the federal system, the person is subject to resentencing. And so a 12-month sentence.
They don't have parole. in the federal system, there's only federal supervised release, right?
They call it something else, yes, Your Honor, but essentially it's the same. Once someone has served 85% of their underlying prison sentence, they're then dispersed into the community where they are subject to community supervision.
Right, they're released for 3 years. It's just not, it's not parole. It's not, doesn't work the way it works in Nevada. Like, it's not a very good analogy, right?
Just so. While it is an analogy that was used, it's also not a good analogy for the reason that the person, when they violate the terms of that community supervision after prison, they are subject to resentencing. And that is why in the federal system under Johnson, to avoid ex post facto and other constitutional infirmities, the federal system hinges the probation, well, their supervision system as a rule of substance, because whenever someone comes back before the federal court, the court can actually increase their underlying remaining sentence, whatever they were sentenced to. So if someone was sentenced to 12 months, for instance, in the cases that were provided to the court, someone could then be sentenced to 36 months of re-imprisonment in the Bureau of Prisons. We have no analog in the Nevada system. We do not allow resentencing. So the sentence that someone is initially pronounced with and then placed on probation or then sent to prison remains their sentence. And while there might be some change based upon good time credits or based upon stat time being taken away, at the end of the day, the underlying sentence remains unchanged throughout the course of probation or parole. So Johnson and indeed the Court of Appeals reliance in Chamberlain on that is misplaced. Rather, the court in the Elwin decision, this court, the Nevada Supreme Court, in an unpublished definitive opinion in a panel, gets it right, saying that the Nevada legislature in enacting AB 236 said specifically that they wanted people who were sentenced after the July 1st, 2020 date to be given the benefits of those graduated sanctions.
In this case, how do we even get there? Because it seems that Mr. McDaniel would not have been eligible for a graduated sanction given the numerous non-technical offenses that were part of his revocation, various revocation proceedings.
I can address that, Your Honor. The issue there is what the court relied on is 176A.630 subsection 2. And in doing so, and in coming to the conclusion that a defendant, when found guilty or stipulating to a non-technical violation, is wholly outside of the ambit of the graduated statutory protections. However, Your Honor, in neither section of NRS 176A.510 or 630 is any of that language countenanced. Indeed, parole and probation is told that it must engage in the graduated sanctions for each and every technical violation. And indeed, the court is told that it only has a series of options when a technical violation is found. So this case hinges on, first, do graduated sanctions, are they required in this circumstance with appellant McDaniel?
Do you believe that a person who has been convicted of a felony who then is possessing a gun is a technical violation?
No, Your Honor. In fact, that's what I said. The Elwin case gets it right, because in Elwin, it provides the opposite extreme of the example here. In the Elwin case, that individual committed a new felony, admits to committing a new felony, probable cause is found, and they're ultimately convicted of it. But they stipulate to the arrest of that new felony as part of their revocation proceedings. And so they are found to have a non-technical violation, as that is the distinction. The issue is here, and like in the Doyle case, Your Honor, the issue is here is that this represents the opposite end of the spectrum. And to be perfectly frank, what I think should be most concerning to the court is what Mr. McDaniel was violated for, found as being non-technical violations, was purely speech. Speech from text messages that were attributed to him without being properly authenticated. Speech that was attributed to him in which an officer had to testify in which to fill in the blanks. So the court's order said that this was a text communications for Percocets and for fentanyl. The fentanyl communication comes from the person texting, purported to text with Mr. McDaniel. The Percocets comes from the word perk, P-E-R-K-S, looking for perks. And the court accepts parole and probation's interpretation of this, speculation, that this must be Percocet pills. It couldn't be anything else. It couldn't be no dose. Likewise, with the firearm that the district court says the text messages refer to the firearm, it does not. In point of fact, the text messages refer only once to a Blick, not a stick,
so
not a trick.
Your position is, I understand what your argument is. Your position is that those are not proven violations, and that left the court only with technical violation of associated with a felon, and what was the other?
Failure to go to counseling, Your Honor.
Failure to go to counseling.
For which we showed effort.
The prior substantive violations, non-technical violations, couldn't be counted in assessing whether those technical violations justified.
Or even if they were counted, it would only count as the third technical violation. It was either the first technical violation or the third technical violation, but it was only the third violation, no matter
how. But you
how
only get there if we credit your argument that the speech was not sufficiently probative or didn't adequately establish the non-technical violations of
just
with
so
respect to the drugs and the firearm.
And though I've run over my time, that is exactly what the court says. Well, there is this back and forth. There is this underlying easiness that the court is going to violate someone for text messages, for speech only, for which there is no proven conduct, for which there is no firearm found, for which there are no drugs found, for which there are no positive drug tests, for which there is no admission by the probationer himself to the probation officer. Yes, I was trying to get drugs. Yes, I was trying to find a firearm.
What this standard is of review do we apply to the court's finding of those violations?
Well, here, Your Honor, I think you have some leeway because it's de novo. I think the court
Why is it de novo?
Because the court started out its analysis by saying that they were going to use the old probation analysis framework of the probationer's performance was not as good as it could have been or as good as it should have been. And specifically, in the court's opinion, the very first holding that they make is that the defendant is not subject to graduated sanctions
based upon
the date of the offense.
But let's assume for the sake of argument they are, and I think the court goes ahead and finds that the last two violations respecting drugs and firearm were sufficiently proven to constitute non-technical violations for which, I mean, we can sweep it all aside, that's the court's finding. What standard of review applies to that finding?
Your Honor, I think that has to be a de novo review as well, because legally here what the court used was the wrong standard at the beginning of the analysis, but moreover, at the end of the analysis, the court itself is confused and ties in this reasonable belief that these facts are verified, ignoring the corpus delicti rule that would be applicable to probable cause. Corpus delicti, of course, requiring that a crime actually took place and that the defendant is the one who did it. The state relied upon the text messages to show that the defendant committed a crime, but failed to show that there was an actual corpus of a crime, failed to show that the defendant wasn't lying and in fact took one step whatsoever other than the text messages towards procuring these putative drugs. If, of course, you accept the officer's determination as to what was being spoken about, because there is nothing in the record before you. Indeed, as you go through the text messages that are included in the appendix, there are text messages between the phone, this phone and other phones, where people are talking about wanting to do drugs because of the frustration involved in dealing with the situation, but they know that that won't be productive. At the end of the day, Your Honor, these are words. There is not a single iota of actual action that is shown by the state, by the probation officer, by the detectives. That's getting over the fact of the detective wasn't there when the gun was there, was taken. The detective isn't the one that did the download of the phone. If you get over all these problems, then what you're left with is at the end of the day, the defendant, at its best case, didn't do anything other than talk about doing these things. Now, this is in direct opposition to something like Doyle, where you have a situation where a probation officer goes out, does breathalyzers, person comes back as a 0.128, is there when the person is arrested for the DUI, finds someone, arrests them for talking about a gun, believing that they had been threatening their neighbors with a gun. When they arrest them, they search the apartment, they don't find anything. But in listening to the phone calls of the defendant and his girlfriend, they then find that the gun has been hidden somewhere else, and using the defendant's own words, find the gun that he was purportedly using. You have none of that here. All you have is the appellant's purported words and the interpretation of them. None of them mentions firearm. None of them mentions drugs. We have perks. We have an individual saying, I want you to help me find a selling point for this fentanyl. But the state doesn't deal with the issue of what happens if he was just trying to mollify a friend. Let's assume everything else is correct. What happens if Mr. McDaniel was simply trying to mollify a friend and say, you know what, I'm looking. But in fact, took no steps. Didn't call, didn't talk to anyone. Why? Because you have no evidence that he did. The district court confused here in their analysis with things that do not disrupt their analysis, such as there being a probation appointment that would have directly contradicted this entirely circumstantial and interpretive evidence that should not have been attributed to Mr. McDaniel. The final point, Your Honor, is an easier one, and that is in the case of Mr. McDaniel, he was failed to be transferred by Department of Corrections. This happens often in our system. And usually, Your Honor, it's worked out between the parties. But in this particular case, the court decided that despite through no fault of Mr. McDaniel's, when he was failed to be transported for the revocation hearing by the Department of Corrections, that he shouldn't be given any of that time as credit. And Your Honor, the state says we have no case law for that. Well, I did dig deep. I did give you some case law for that. But even that case law says we find it hard to find a legal principle to justify this idea that a ministerial actor like a prison officer or a warden can hold someone for 40 years on a one-year sentence while failing to transport them. And that is going to somehow accrue to the defendant's detriment. Even a court wouldn't be allowed to do that. Your Honor, I think this is the opportunity to actually make it Nevada law that says when the fault is not the defendant's, when prison fails to transport someone for a scheduled court hearing, and that impacts their credit for time served calculation, that tie, that question goes to the defendant, not to the state. Thank you.
Okay, proceed. May it please the court, my name is Karen Mishler and I represent the state of Nevada in this matter. The district court did not abuse its discretion by revoking Mr. McDaniel's probation because its decision was based on verified facts that reasonably satisfied the court that Mr. McDaniel's conduct had not been as good as required by his probation conditions. The court correctly found based on longstanding law that the law governing a defendant's probation revocation is the statute in effect at the time of the crime's commission. The court stated in Castillo that statutory amendments are presumed to operate prospectively in the absence of clear legislative intent for retroactive application. This principle was then further affirmed in Pullen years later when the court stated that the relevant penalty is that which was in effect when the defendant committed the crime. Consequently, Mr. McDaniel was not eligible for the system of graduated sanctions enacted by the legislature after he committed the offenses. It is undisputed that Mr. McDaniel committed these offenses in December of 2018. He was indicted in 2019, and the legislative amendments to NRS 176A.510 and NRS 176A.630 passed in 2019 and went into effect on July 1st, 2020. My position is twofold. The district court was correct in finding that the 2019 amendments to the probation statutes creating the graduated sanctions did not apply to Mr. McDaniel. The state urges the court to find that a defendant is subject to the probationary procedural rules in effect at the time of the crime's commission and not at the time of sentencing. But even should this court disagree with that and find that the district court erred in reaching this conclusion, Mr. McDaniel would still not be entitled to relief in this case because the record shows that he committed new offenses that would qualify as non-technical violations under the new version of NRS 176A.510. The record supports the district court's finding that the defendant committed these new offenses. So focusing on ground one, the amendments to NRS 176A.510 do not apply here because they were not explicitly made retroactive. There is no clear legislative intent to make them retroactive.
Ms. Mishler, isn't there some legislative history to suggest that there was an intention for this to apply at sentencing forward?
I would say no. For two reasons. One is that The law is clear that the legislature must demonstrate its clear intent to apply a statute retroactively. And ultimately, whether a statute operates prospectively or retrospectively is a question of statutory construction.
Would that be retroactive if, I mean, because it's not the penalty, right? It's how probation works. So if the person is sentenced to probation post 7/1/20, it makes some sense that the statute, that the probation, the law impacting how probation works would apply to that person.
I understand, but I think if the legislature actually intended that to be the case, they would have explicitly written that into the statute. And actually, the legislative action taken in the subsequent 2020 special session regarding a similar statute, but not the statute at issue here today, shows that the legislature would have explicitly made this the case.
I share Justice Bell's concern, because putting the label of retroactivity on something then triggers the express legislative declaration as, you know, that they want the statute to operate retroactively. But that's not required if it's not a true retroactivity issue, but rather one of, does the statute apply to this event going forward? So, and this goes to the procedure by which probation revocation is determined. And at the time you're sentenced would seem to me to be the event to which that statute's applying, because it's going to govern how any probationary periods, if you're put on probation, are going to be withdrawn from you in a probation revocation proceeding. I mean, there's a lot of cases that say, and I think Scalia and Garner's book on statutory interpretation, that the hard question is whether or not, you know, what's the starting date for the statute, not whether or not there's a retroactive application to something that may have occurred in the past. Civil case, we amend the rules of civil procedure. They apply to all cases pending as of the date of that amendment. So I'm just kind of torn by applying retroactivity here.
Okay, I understand that. I think they're essentially, I have three responses to that. One, I think it's reasonable to interpret this statute as not being in conflict with Pullen. Pullen itself states that the appropriate penalty is that in effect at the time the offense was committed, which in this case was 2018.
That either increased or decreased the penalty that would apply to the conduct, so it measured back to the criminal act, right? It was a possession of a weapon.
Right. In this case, the conduct occurred in 2018, and essentially a probation revocation is an extension of the original sentence, because the court is not tasked with punishing the defendant for this new conduct. The court, I mean, as counsel pointed out, the court is stuck with the original sentence and is just changing the conditions under which they're serving that sentence.
Really? But do we even get to that issue though here?
I think that's essentially up to the court. My position is that Mr. McDaniel is not eligible for graduated sanctions based on the timing. But two, the record is clear that he committed violations, committed new offenses of possession of firearm by prohibited person, and as well as conspiracy to engage in sale of controlled substances.
Okay.
And I think,
Ms. Mishler, maybe you can clear something up for me, because what is not clear to me from the statute is what happens when somebody gets reinstated on a non-technical violation, but then commits a technical violation, where that leaves us, because sometimes, you know, a judge will give somebody a break when somebody commits a non-technical violation, but intends for them to follow the rules pretty closely because they've not done great. Does the judge then have to revert to the technical violations?
Your Honor, I agree with you that I think this is actually an oversight in the statute. So I think the district court was somewhat wrestling with how to deal with a defendant who twice had stipulated to committing what would be non-technical violations and had his probation be reinstated, And then now, arguably, if the new version of the statute applies, he's committing technical violations. And I don't think the statute actually contemplates that sort of scenario. I think the statute is kind of silent as to that. I think the district court's interpretation that it doesn't was consistent with common sense, but it's not actually explicitly stated in the statute. I think it's arguably just an oversight in that statute. But we don't have to get there because that wasn't the basis of the revocation in this case.
So could you address the adequacy of the proof of the non-technical violation?
Yes, Justice.
Okay. In the third.
Right. And I think what we need to remember is that the evidence beyond a reasonable doubt is not required for revocation and probation. That's stated in Lewis, that's stated in Dale, that's always been the case. And the court just needs to have sufficient evidence to show that the defendant's conduct was not as good as that required for probation. And a conviction or formal charges is not necessary in order to demonstrate that the defendant committed a new offense.
Right, but if the graduated sanctions apply and and then the door closed on the prior ones because they were already resolved and his probation was not revoked, then unless you have a new non-technical violation, it's not clear to me, and you refer to it as oversight, that you can revoke without, when you have technical violations remaining in the graduated scheme. So
yes, I agree. So what we have here, we don't necessarily have to get there because what we have here is sufficient evidence that Mr. McDaniel committed non-technical violations by committing new offenses that would clearly under the statute.
But if we were to conclude that there wasn't sufficient evidence, then we would have to get there.
That's correct.
Yeah.
But I think we have sufficient evidence here. And much of the briefing regarding Rodriguez and the authentication of the text messages, I think Rodriguez is a relevant guideline, but I want to reiterate that in Rodriguez the court was addressing whether the evidentiary rules in Title IV of the NRS had been complied with, and those evidentiary rules don't actually apply at a probation revocation under NRS 47.020. But regarding the proof contained within the text messages, there was at the time of Mr. McDaniel's arrest, there was a black iPhone discovered on his person. The forensic download of the phone showed that the phone number was the same as that had been registered with the Department of Parole and Probation. There were user accounts on the phone tied to the name Ken Juan McDaniel. There were message conversations in which the sender of the messages identified himself as Ken Juan and asked for Percocet using the term perks. And the district court heard testimony from four different people at the relevant revocation hearing, the February 2024 hearing. The detective who located the black iPhone on the defendant's person, the detective who found the other gray iPhone on the inside of the home in the chair cushions, as well as the detective who did the forensic download of the phone, and then lastly, Mr. McDaniel's probation officer, who provided important context to the meaning of these messages. So he gave testimony that perks is slang for Percocet, and then additionally that blues refer to fentanyl. There was a text message on that black iPhone in which Mr. McDaniel agreed to help locate purchasers for fentanyl. The gray iPhone that was located in his home contained user accounts associated with the same Gmail email address as the black iPhone. There were credit cards associated with phone accounts in Mr. McDaniel's name. There were multiple emails sent to that email addressed to Ken Juan or Ken Juan McDaniel. The messages on that phone were regarding the firearm, and Officer Avalar, the probation officer, testified that Blix is common street vernacular for a firearm. And I mean, probably one of the most important aspects of his testimony was that on August 15th of 2023, Mr. McDaniel sent a text message saying that he would grab his Blick once his PO left, and that his PO should be here in like 2 to 3 hours max. I mean, that's establishing criminal activity and identity, because on that date, Officer Avalar was meeting with Mr. McDaniel. He testified to that. And
the point is that if he had never had any other history of probation violations and we confronted these phones, that this would be sufficient to revoke him without regard to the graduated sanction?
Yes, absolutely. And the standard of review in just reviewing that question is actually an abuse of discretion. That's stated in Lewis, if considering just whether or not the district court erred in revoking a defendant's probation, that standard is absolutely abuse of discretion. When we talk about statutory interpretation, I understand that's different, that's de novo, but if we're looking at, if you make the decision that the new version of the statute applies and your question is just whether the district court found sufficient evidence of these non-technical violations, the standard of review is abuse of discretion, and we don't have.
Did I hear you say that the rules of evidence don't apply to this determination?
What I meant was, I was referring to all of the rules of evidence contained within Title IV of the NRS, which chapters 48 through about 52, which are regarding hearsay and authentication. Those by statute do not apply to probation revocation hearings.
So you're saying authentication does not apply?
I'm not necessarily saying that. I'm saying what does apply instead of those statutes is the ruling from Anaya, which, because obviously the defendant still has due process rights, but those statutes don't actually have to be complied with because they're inapplicable. But the as Anaya said, a defendant has due process rights at a probation. Right, correct. And a probation revocation needs to be based on verified facts. Of course, Anaya says that as well. So that's the standard. I wasn't saying that there were no evidentiary rules at all, just those specific statutes, of course. And I think what we have here are verified facts. The court heard evidence and testimony from the individuals who recovered the phones, the download, and she found credible Officer Avalar's testimony about the meaning of these of these messages. So I think we absolutely have sufficient evidence for the district court to find that Mr. McDaniel's behavior on probation was not as good as what was required under his probation conditions. We absolutely have sufficient evidence of him committing these new offenses. The standard is not reasonable doubt. It's just the court just has to be reasonably satisfied of these new offenses.
Quickly address the credit issue.
Yes, Your Honor. And so under NRS 176.055 subsection 1, a defendant cannot receive credit for confinement pursuant to a judgment of conviction for another offense. In this case, that's for case C369434. It's not disputed that he was sentenced in that case on December 12th of 2023.
There's some sort of equity problem, though, like when he doesn't have the ability to get himself to court. I understand what the law is, but it's a mm-hmm. little bit of a troubling outcome.
I understand that, but he is receiving credit in the particular case for which he's serving a prison sentence. So he's not entitled to receive credit in two cases. Additionally, I think this is a case where the statute is very clear. So I don't think there's much that can be done for him without overruling that statute. And that's the state's position ultimately. So I will just say Mr. McDaniel is not entitled to the benefit of a statute that was not yet in effect when he committed the offenses resulting in his probation. But even should this court rule otherwise on that issue, the district court can't be found to have abused its discretion by revoking Mr. McDaniel's probation because the court was reasonably satisfied that Mr. McDaniel committed new felony offenses of possession of firearm by prohibited person and conspiracy to sell narcotics. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Koss.
Briefly, Your Honor. This court's intervention is necessary to deal with a split between the Court of Appeals and the Nevada Supreme Court. This split implicitly overruled in the Elwin case, Your Honor. This was the 2024 Nevada unpublished Lexis 832 case that was alluded to in the opening brief, which the state does not even address. And the reason why is because the Owen case says very clearly, while it's an unpublished decision, the relevant statutory amendment when talking about AB 236 and these statutory frameworks has an effective date of July 1st, 2020. The legislature subsequently changed the effective date, so the amended provision applies to offenses committed before July 1st, 2020, but only if the offender is sentenced on or after July 1st, 2020. This case matches that holding. And while it is an unpublished decision, Your Honor, it is exactly on point. What's more than that, it makes more sense than attempting to apply the federal standard here because we don't go through the resentencing that they do in the federal courts where they actually apply a higher penalty. Put simply, the Chamberlain line of cases must be overruled by this court. They were instrumental and the foundational piece in which the district court relied in finding that the appellant here was not subject to the graduated sanctions. If the court finds that he is subject to graduated sanctions pursuant to that Elwin decision and overturning the contrary Court of Appeals decisions, then what we're left with is, how do we deal with this situation? And the reason why I argue that this is not simply an abuse of discretion, it's because the court's use of the not as good as could have been standard throughout the course of its analysis goes from beginning to end. It used the wrong legal standard. Anaya says very clearly, Your Honors, that what we're talking about here is a probable cause standard, the same standard that would be used at a preliminary hearing or in front of the grand jury. That's why we allow a preliminary hearing finding to stand in place of that in probation violations. But the court here ignores that probable cause standard. Why? Because the corpus delicti issue. As part of that question, the court embraces, as part of the oral argument and as part of its findings, that there is a problem with corpus delicti here, but it sidesteps the issue, instead finding that there are verified facts for which there was no gun, no drugs, no underlying charges, no conviction, no admission, nothing than the speech of the defendant purportedly used to convict him. That is improper, and we'd ask you to overrule and find in his favor. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the briefing and argument from counsel, and we'll submit the case and be in recess. I apologize for the heat in the courtroom.
I think we understand. It's not
actually in my office is 106 degrees.
That's nice. Well, the air conditioning on my house went out a couple of weeks ago, so I got it fixed.
I was told it was raining in the public defender's offices as well.